Ho, ho, ho. Oh, it's too early for that, but it isn't too early to let you know that this December 3rd, Monday, December 3rd, is the second annual Heritage Radio Network fundraising party and tasting at the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens in Brooklyn, New York, obviously. It's a wonderful event. We did the first one last year, and it was a blast. You can meet Heritage Radio Network hosts like myself. You can sample food from some of the best chefs in New York. You can participate in an auction. You could drink some great wine. And it's all for a great cause, which is supporting Heritage Radio Network and its wonderful programming. If you would like to buy tickets, please visit heritageradionetwork.org/gala. And if you would like a 10% discount, you can get that on your first ticket by using the promo code AndrewTalksToChefs. Hope to see you there.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
From time to time, we did regional menus. So we'd do like a Sicilian menu, a Roman menu. We would do that for a whole season and you know, totally authentic recipes from all those places. But I felt it was really important to have a really solid respect and understanding for what authentic cooking is, because I couldn't do anything from that until I learned what that was.
That is Chef Amy Brandwine of Centralina Restaurant in Washington, D.C., our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses
to make some sense of this.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. And as I think everybody knows by now, I think we have all of our pre-recorded intros already deployed, and people know that I am trying to get a backlog of interviews out to all of you, and I'm doing relatively short intros. That's good news to some people who have voiced their opinion on social media and iTunes. That's bad news to people who have voiced the opposite opinion. It's really bad news for those of you who miss Caitlin. It's not just that the intros are short. She's on a business trip to Los Angeles this week, so that wasn't going to happen anyway, but I am here to introduce to you Amy Brandwine. Amy Brandwine is one of the best chefs currently operating in Washington, D.C. I know that, even though I have not been to her restaurant, Centralina, because she's made several best of D.C. lists across all kinds of different sensibilities, Eater, The Washington Post, on and on, some of which have had her up in the top two or three restaurants in town. And I can also, as I think is often the case, just sort of tell from how smart, passionate, thoughtful she was when we sat down for this interview. I have to be honest, this is an embarrassingly late dropping of this interview. Amy and I interviewed during the lull or the hiatus between seasons at the end of the summer in August in New York City when she was visiting New York. It got kind of lost in the shuffle of the beginning of the season. And then with the twice a week postings, I've just been looking for where I thought it would fit in best into the mix. And this is that day. Amy, as you will hear, in addition to being a really serious and successful practitioner of the Italian culinary arts, is a career switcher. You'll notice in the interview when we get to it, I was quite surprised at how late she came to the kitchen. She also has a lot to say about what it's like being a woman chef in both D.C., which traditionally has been very male-dominated in the professional kitchens, and also in the Italian kitchens that she came up in. So there's a whole lot here. And in addition to all of that, there's a great personal story, and I just think you'll enjoy hearing me speak to Amy as much as I enjoyed doing it myself. She was just completely, I thought, open, honest, and very straightforward in everything she had to say. So that's all I'm going to say about it. Again, this was recorded a few months back. I don't think much has changed since then, but this is my interview with Chef Amy Brandwine of Centralina. Here you go.
I'm from Washington, D.C., but more specifically, I grew up in Arlington, Virginia.
And so. what was it like growing up in Arlington?
It was great. I mean, Arlington was not like as much of a metropolitan area as it is now. So it was like a little bit of a smaller town, but still very much like, kind of a government, you know, area. Like the entire DC region is kind of built around, you know, the government.
So. Yeah. I knew, you may have known him. I did a book years ago. He had a tragic ending a few years ago. Walter Scheib, who had been the White House chef.
Ah, yes.
And he lived in Virginia.
Yes.
And there was a space between the city and his home where the phone would cut out. And
yes.
He explained to me that that was because he was going near the CIA. Have you ever heard this?
No, but when
does that sound plausible? Or?
Yeah, because when I drive by, 395 is the highway that goes from D.C. to Arlington, and I still live in Arlington, so when you drive by the Pentagon, your service goes out.
It does.
Yeah.
That is so interesting.
Yeah, don't make a phone call when you're by the Pentagon.
Yeah. No, because we would have these long, we were collaborating on a book, and like, he'd say, I'm getting close, eventually it was shorthand. He would just say, I'm getting close, so I'll call you back.
Yep.
And then he'd hang up.
Right.
So did you consider yourself, like, I've always wondered about this, like, do you consider yourself a native of D.C., or do you consider yourself a native of Arlington, or both?
Kind of both. I mean, like, the question is when people say, oh, where are you from? When you talk to somebody in Washington, like, they say, where are you from?
Yeah.
You know, you don't necessarily want to say I'm a Washingtonian, because to most people who are local, that means you're born in Washington, D.C., and which is a very rare occurrence, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm a Washingtonian through and through, but I spent most of my life in Arlington, Virginia, Alexandria, and then interestingly enough, like, you know, most of the professional work I've always had has been in Washington. So I spent a majority of my time in D.C.
Yeah.
And it's a small area. So all the different areas are kind of mixed up together.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. So when, if I ask you to think back to when you were a kid, and the first sort of pinch that, whether or not you knew it then, the first sort of pinch that led you down the road to what you do today, whether you would call it a love of food, an interest in cooking, restaurants, television and books. Like, what, when you look back now, what's the first thing you see that you think, oh, that's where it started, or that's where the first sign of it was?
You know, I was always cooking when I was little. So after school, I would be constantly I would open the Betty Crocker cookbook, because that was all that existed at the time, really.
Uh-huh.
And so
that was,
I would,
like, something your family had?
Yeah. It was just whatever was at the house. Yeah. And so I would be flipping through it, and I would try to make whatever it was, a cake, a cookie.
Yeah.
My first memory of food was really cooking pasta with my mom. I'm not Italian, but we were actually cooking. I don't have, my mom is not like one of these amazing like home cooks. I don't have that kind of, my dad is a very good home cook. My mom was a working mom. And so my first memory of cooking was actually making spaghetti with her. And, we had the tomato sauce, and we had the boiling pasta water. I remember I just did something very stupid, and I think I poured the tomato sauce into the boiling water with the pasta, because I didn't understand what she was saying, and we ruined dinner. But so that, I remember that, and then...
You're just ahead of your time. That would be called tomato water now.
It is. It's a famous dish. It's tomato water, yeah. And, I think my other memory was just my first... I had a very... My on vacation, my dad's side of the family, we used to go up to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and so there's amazing raspberries there around the summertime. So we would go and collect raspberries. Well, you can imagine how many raspberries you need to make one pie, right? A lot.
Yeah.
But there was a woman in around the corner from our cabin. She was like this expert pie maker. So I just said, like, I really want to learn how to make pie. So like the first thing I really did, like through and through, was making a raspberry pie.
When you said you went, you mean you just went to her and asked if she would teach you?
Yeah.
What did she like sell it like farmers markets and stuff?
No. This was like a no. It was just the summertime and like I.
This is what she did.
This is what she did.
Some people read all summer. Some people sell.
She made pies. So I was bored, and you know, there's not much to do on this island of like population 750 people.
Yeah.
So I just decided that I was going to ask her if she would teach me how to make pie, and you know, she did. So that was my first like serious cooking episode. I do remember like that when I made it, it came out beautifully. Like there wasn't a disaster with it, you know? So I kind of feel like, you know, pie is one of my favorite things to make actually. And I think it's like the touch of the dough, and just like the texture and the touch and that kind of thing, not overworking it. And so, yeah, it was a really amazing experience, and it was a really good pie. So that kind of, really stuck with me.
How old were you roughly?
I would probably say I was around, 8 years old.
Wow.
But I was cooking other things. I was having disasters at home trying to make recipes, not having all the ingredients. I was doing that as long as I could, probably like 6, something like that.
Really?
Yeah.
Just because you enjoyed it?
Yeah. I don't know. That was what I did after school.
Were you thinking professional at that point? Or?
No.
No.
I remember telling my father at some point I was going to be, I was either going to be a lawyer. I think it was a lawyer or something now, a lawyer or a writer. And I do think chef was there. I think it was there, but it wasn't anything that was like a serious thought. It was just what I did. Like I was,
that was the thing you actually,
those were the things that I enjoyed doing. Like I liked to read.
Yeah.
I did like to cook.
Yeah.
And so I had no idea what I was going to be though.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Did you, the baking thing is so interesting to me. I don't bake. I have a fear, an intense fear of it. I think part of it is that I think you have to be really confident to bake well, because you are unlike, again, most savory things, with however they end up coming to the plate, you get a chance to sort of futz with it before it goes out, right?
Right.
And I'm talking as just a home cook. When you're baking, you do whatever you do. You put it in the oven, and then you're sort of, that's a leap of faith, that moment.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And am I making sense?
Absolutely.
But that seems to me like a real divide among people who cook. Like, that is something that, for me, it would just be anxiety provoking, like waiting to see if it worked.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big difference between pastry chefs and savory chefs. Like, pastry chefs are very exacting, very meticulous.
Yeah.
And it's an exercise in patience. You know, you have to do everything correctly or it's not going to come out correctly,
yes.
You know?
Yes.
So you can't fudge the, you know, the recipe. You can't really sort of like fudge some of these very important things like baking soda, baking powder.
Right.
You can't put them in different combinations or different orders or you're not going to get the same result. So, but for me, it was the only thing that I could really practice with, because it was like, you know, there was really no danger in making a cookie, but I wasn't going to like get on the stove and I didn't have any idea what I was doing.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I mean, I love baking. But it's very hard.
Yeah.
So
you are the second chef that's been on in this calendar year who said that being a lawyer was in some ways a consideration or a passing consideration. Those two things seem completely polar to me, right? They seem so incompatible to me. Do you make any sense of it? Or like when you look back, is there something about you that that seems to jibe with that alternative reality?
Being a lawyer?
Yeah.
You know, my mom, well, I mean, I have a very interesting sort of like family background because my mom was a congressional staffer. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So, like, it was all around me, like politics, law, legislation.
Yeah.
Like, it was just, you know, how a bill becomes a law was just like part of what was around me when I was growing up, you know.
And were you curious about it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my mom and I, you know, I'm just a bill
work,
on like, Capitol Hill. You know, that thing was like...
the first thing I thought of when you said,
that
yeah.
was like my life, you know. I mean, my mom was like, you know, she... this is really like right. what... I mean, she used to take me to work. I mean, she used to take me to work. So we would go to the Hill and I yeah. would be like playing with a copying machine because, you know, that was the only thing to do. I'd be yeah. like copying my hand or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But so, yeah, I mean, that part of me was like, you know, I love to read. I love to write. So that was like kind of seemed like a natural way to express that part of it. But he was a cameraman for NBC News,
wow.
a sound man. So he started out with the Army doing sound, and then they transferred him to the White House. So he stayed at the White House from Kennedy all the way up until the first Bush.
Uh-huh.
And so, but besides that, he's an avid gardener, which is where the cooking really came in.
Oh my God.
So, and it kind of, I was thinking about this the other day, it kind of like all the dots sort of make sense. So he had a farm, well, I'm not talking farm, I'm saying a plot of land on our house, like
yeah.
that he had a little, you know, farm. So he was doing urban gardening back in the 70s
uh-huh.
in Arlington, and
yeah.
that didn't really exist at the time, right? So he was, like, growing green beans and, you know, and then inside he was growing alfalfa sprouts
wow.
and all these things. So he was kind of like, you know, a technician,
yeah.
meaning, like, very detail-oriented and, like, obviously, like, minutiae of like you do, like minutia of sound or camera
mm-hmm.
or lenses or creating a moment or whatever. That was what he did every day. And then his passion and his, besides that, was gardening, you know, food. He was a cook. He's still around. He still cooks, but he is an avid cook and baker.
He's a Renaissance man.
He really is. So it was, you know, kind of, I'm sort of like a perfect, like, combination of the both of them, I guess, is the best way to explain it.
Because so, you have all that interest in the sort of
yeah.
Sensory
right.
pleasure stuff that he did, and then you have your mom's sort of analytical.
Yeah. yeah. The only way I can explain my interests or how all this came about is just by, you know, saying I'm just a combination of the two
yeah.
the two people who raised me, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
So,
not
and the environment that I was in.
Not always the case, but I mean, sometimes it's,
yeah,
you know, the polar opposite of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I just ask, just curiously, your dad's, can I ask like what his background was culturally or ethnically? Did he come from?
Irish.
Irish.
Yeah.
Okay.
And my mom, Irish too.
Okay.
So, I'm almost like 100% Irish, actually.
Okay.
My background.
But I don't, am I wrong? I don't connect that culture necessarily with the kind of, like when you talk about the, you know, this elaborate garden that he had, I
right.
think maybe like Italian or
yeah.
Assyrian or, you know, but I don't think Irish.
I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, he just was like, yeah, like if you say Renaissance, he's very into nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so he actually lives that island I was talking about before where I learned how to make pie for the first
yeah.
time. It's like actually like, you know, one of these, I guess it's like natural wonder or something.
Yeah.
So it's a preserved lands. He's very much into nature and he lives there full time now. So I guess, you know, his appreciation for fresh things and growing things and kind of exploring all this
mm-hmm.
health food that was going on in the 70s kind of like encouraged my interest in farming or like fresh food, I guess.
So at what age do you start thinking this might be what you want to do with your life?
30.
30? What did you do? Oh my God.
I know.
I have to say, this is one of those moments. You can prep, but you don't always prep. I actually did look up some article. I didn't come across this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me, what did you do before that?
I went to college for political science and then graduated, went back to Washington. I worked for two lobbying firms and a political action committee.
Wow.
And then I decided I wanted to start cooking. So I kind of like methodically plotted my next step, but I had to quit my job and then go to culinary school at 30.
How did you like being in the political realm?
I loved it. So like that analytical side of me, one of the best things is like I got to go to the Hill all the time and like sit in on these hearings and any kind of important legislation. Like I was sitting there listening to the debates going on about everything. And, you know, one of my principal jobs was just to summarize what happened in memos and we'd send them to the clients and stuff. But, you know, it's fascinating. But, you know, there's like a lot of it that I wasn't really crazy about, like the, coordinating like fundraising breakfasts or something like that. Those kinds of things, it was like kind of like I didn't want to do that. And in order for me to like continue with that part of my career, I really knew that it wasn't just going to be like writing memos and covering issues. Yeah. It was going to be more of that other stuff, which I didn't really want to do. So I just love to cook. So I just decided like I should probably try to figure out what I really want to do.
So I'm not trying to manufacture one, but was there a break point? Like, was there a moment where either the political stuff just became unbearable or where the desire to shift and cook became irresistible? Like, was there a moment where, do you remember when you were finally having that, let yourself have that thought of, that's a big switch.
Right.
To go from what you were doing, especially if you're like almost 30 or 30.
Right. Yeah. There was just this one thing. There was just this one task that my boss at the time asked me to do, which was organize this breakfast fundraiser with people involved in securities law and stuff. And I just can't do this. Like, I don't feel comfortable doing this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I had no interest in it. I didn't really want to do it. And I was just like, I just can't handle this. So,
there's gotta be more to life than this.
Well,
it's not
for me. Yeah. It's not for me. Yeah. Like, it doesn't excite me. It,
yeah.
it makes me like anxiety ridden, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It entertaining people at 8 o'clock in the morning, wasn't what I wanted to do. So,
right.
And then I just was like constantly cooking. And so there wasn't one split moment. It was just, I spent all my free time cooking or studying cooking, reading
mm-hmm.
cookbooks.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just that thing where I'm like, I think I'm so interested in this that I can't imagine not trying it, you know?
Right. So let me ask you to be potentially immodest for a moment, right? During these years, when in the back of your mind, you're having this thought about cooking, where you're reading all these books. I assume you probably saw some cooks on television.
All of them, yeah.
You're going to restaurants in D.C., you're sort of this untapped chef inside, right? Were you comparing yourself, what you were doing at home, what you had a notion you might be capable of, with what you were experiencing around town? Like, were you looking at what was happening and seeing how you thought you could or couldn't stack up against that?
I think I think I was just, yeah, I was.
I'm
like,
not asking you to diss anybody. I just mean, like, did you see food around town and go, yeah, I cook that well?
No, I never felt like that. But there were certain things that I felt like, gosh, you know, there must be a better pesto around, or, you know, just like, why is everything so not authentic? I guess that was really like what I felt like. Like, I just, I just felt like a very deep, like, I don't know, like a deep love for doing something, making something meaningful, you know? So, I felt very like motivated to whatever it was, had high intrinsic value, like, you know, like that I felt like I could make a contribution because I really thought deeply about all these things, you know,
yeah.
like the science of cooking, like mm-hmm. the chemical composition of things, like the steps to doing something perfectly. You know, those are all the things that I would like read over and over again, or, you know, I am a very strong believer in like executing basic principles of cooking correctly.
Do you believe there's a right way and a wrong way to do things?
I don't think there's one way, but I think in general, like, yeah,
there's a wrong way.
There's a wrong way. There might be another
right way.
There might be more than one right way, but I think what I'm trying to say is that there's sometimes people lose appreciation for basic principles of cooking. So like how to properly braise something. Sometimes people don't appreciate these things anymore,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
How to correctly sear something or why you're doing it that way, or, you know, the steps to perfectly frying something. And, you know, a lot of these things like, you know, are super important. And sometimes even now, like, you know, it's really important to when I'm training cooks is try to get them to just, you need to execute this part of it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise we can't get to the next part of it.
Right.
You know, the
foundational
the
stuff.
Foundation
yeah.
is what that's like. That's one of the things I'm really passionate about is the foundation
yeah.
of certain parts of the steps and how do you get there?
Yeah. So you decide to go to cooking school.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you go?
I went to the Academy of Cuisine. It's in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small French school.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And how'd you settle on that?
It was local.
Yeah.
It was the only one.
That would have been my first guess.
Yeah. And so I had already gone to college
yeah.
and done that. And I already had student loans from that. And I was like, you know, I had just gotten engaged. Yeah, I had just gotten engaged. And I wasn't able to move to New York.
Yeah.
And so it was like the only reasonable option.
Yeah.
So I started there. I took one nighttime class there just to get my feet wet to make sure that it was like what I wanted to do before I like, you know, went off the deep end.
Yeah.
And, you know, after that 6 month period, I was like, yep, I still love this. So I'm going to keep going with it.
Did you take to it right away? Like when you first started doing it, was it immediately like, yes, I made the right decision?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. As soon as I had my first class, I was like, this is definitely for
uh-huh.
me. Yeah.
What was going in at that age, what was that like for you physically, which depending on different people, some who start later have told me, yeah, that was an adjustment.
Right.
And what was it like socially?
Physically, not too much. I was an avid soccer player when I was younger, from 6 all the way up through college. So I have really strong legs.
Mm-hmm.
So that is really helpful for cooking because
mm-hmm.
you have to be, well, I guess because you have to be on your feet all the time. And then, you know, if you have strong legs, you don't really have back problems
right.
and things. And just the athleticism that I was kind of used to really helped me out in the kitchen
mm-hmm.
because I, you know, it's... You know, if you can play, you know, 90 minutes of soccer, I think
right.
you can make it through a service in the kitchen. There are, you know, so that part of it was not as difficult for me. And
yeah.
I do credit, like, being athletic to that. So that part was pretty much okay. And then, you know, in terms of the social part of it, going to school again was kind of funny just because, like, there was a lot of kids in my class that were, like, a lot younger, and this was, like, their first experience, like, out of the womb, you know. So
yeah.
A lot of people were, like, partying right after class ended, and I was like, this is really, like, kind of crazy and juvenile, you know, like, what, well, we have to, you know, how are we going to, like, we have class tomorrow, and it just seemed like it was really expensive. It was only a year.
Yeah.
So I had a much more serious, kind of approach to it because I knew all the stakes of what I had done. Like I had like quit my job.
Right.
I had, you know, I didn't have a job. Like
yeah.
I was not, this was not being paid by, you know, mom and dad were not paying for this. I
yeah.
was paying for this.
Yeah.
And if I screwed it up or something, you know, it didn't come to fruition, I had wasted a lot of money. But
mm-hmm.
I knew that, like, I could still, if I learned how to cook at the end of the day, I'd still be happy. But I just took it a lot more seriously than everybody else did, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was much more intense and took it a lot more seriously.
Yeah. Was that difficult for you?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. Because it was, like, kind of, like, it seemed almost like cool for people not to be paying attention, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And I just was like, you know, I was the one who was like, I was always asking questions, mm-hmm. you know, I laborious notes, like, yeah. you know, like every detail, you know, like very kind of, I guess, sort of dorky, you know.
But have you ever had this conversation with anyone else who'd been in your position? Because this is not, I've heard a similar tale from other chefs who came to it a little bit later than most people
do. Oh, really?
Yeah, like Alfred Portale at the Gotham, who gave me my break as a writer. I co-wrote his all of his books, but he started school a little later because he had been a jewelry designer.
Uh-huh.
The way you just described it, so it was like a party situation.
Yeah.
But, he was there to learn and was very serious. And his nickname was Mr. Perfect.
Oh, gosh.
And as he said to me, it was not a compliment.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think there was a fair amount of, like, it was really weird because you're supposed to work in teams, and, like, some people didn't want to work on a team, and people were just acting really juvenile, and I was like, you know, I just want to, like, get through this project,
yeah.
and I want to just do a good job, and, like, it just seemed like just a lot of extra drama, and I had these two instructors, you know,
yeah.
and then I had the pastry instructor, and I was like, I just want to learn everything that I need to learn so mm-hmm. that when I get out of this class and I go wherever I go, like
yeah.
that I'm doing a good job, and all the theoretical things about cooking are important, you know, and, I don't know. I got a lot out of it. It wasn't really fun though. It was really hard. It was really hard.
Okay.
Just the transition was like kind of strange just because of my age and the amount of pressure I was putting on myself
yes.
to get through this part of it. So I can kind of like decide like, yeah, I didn't make like a terrible mistake. You
well,
know?
The other thing, when I've talked to people who we would now call career changers, right? There seems to me to be this feeling amongst you and your ilk that, well, you know what? This better be it. You know, like I'm 30 now, and like I made this commitment. I spent all this money. I'm trying this. Like, I'm not going to try something after this, right?
Right.
Was that kind of part of it?
Right.
That's an enormous amount of stress to have on yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I always felt like, yeah, I guess I could go back to what I was doing, but I didn't really want to. So there was like, you know, just sort of like a lot of pressure to like, you know, make this happen.
Yeah.
And not knowing what I was getting into either.
Right. So you mentioned a few minutes when I asked you about dining around, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you gave us an example, pesto.
Mm-hmm.
When did you start to zero in your own head? And maybe we're not there yet in your chronology, but when did you start to think about the kind of food you were personally interested in?
Probably about the time I started thinking about going to culinary school. I just gravitated all the time towards tomato and pesto and things like that and pasta. So, it was kind of a no-brainer that I was going to go try to cook in an Italian kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, because I have no connection to Italy. It's just, I love all these flavors, you know, so I...
Had you been to Italy at this point?
No. Nope.
Did you, was a lot of your reading, were you reading a lot of Italian cookbooks to try to get a sense of what real was?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was. And I was reading a lot of like classic French culinary techniques, you know,
mm-hmm.
like Madeleine Kamen and,
mm-hmm.
and people like Julia Child
uh-huh.
and Marcella Hazan.
Yeah.
Those are the kind of books that I was reading, you know. So yeah,
so
I
very
was
texty.
Very texty.
Very
yeah.
scholarly is probably a little too dull a word for it. But very detailed, very authoritative.
Yeah. Those are still
books.
The kind of books that I like to read.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
I like the way, I mean, because it's like deeper sort of like deep thought process about cooking, the way they speak about the different things. It's like kind of on a more serious thing than like, here's a cookbook by a famous chef. And these are the, you know, that's, I like theoretical. I'm sort of like theoretical.
Mm-hmm.
So those types of books like appeal to me, I guess.
I will say I still cook out of, and it was like when they moved once, my late stepmother just whatever, I guess she was cleaning house or editing down her cookbook. She gave me Julia Child's The Way to Cook.
Yeah.
I used that book.
That's a great book.
The detail and the recipes. Like, when I make beef stew, I use the recipe in that book, and it totally transformed the way I make beef stew. There's things I never had seen in other books. A couple of little
things.
She doesn't call them tricks. They're just part of the recipe. Right.
Did you ever make her lemon chicken in that book?
No.
It's amazing.
Should I?
So simple. Yeah.
All right.
With a roasted, I can't quite explain it, but it's like the execution of it is like you have the perfect chicken, you have the perfect vegetables, you have the perfect broth.
Yeah.
And the perfect seasoning, like a little bit of lemon in it. It's terrific.
Well, so like this beef stew recipe, this is your interview, but just quickly, because I think it's interesting. One of the incredible steps is you steam some of the vegetables that are going in, and you steam them over a measured amount of water. Mm-hmm. And then after they've cooked, you reduce that liquid down. And the last thing you add to the braising liquid before you fold the meat back in and everything else is that really super reduced, basically vegetable stock that you've made. And it just gives the slightest hint of all those flavors.
Interesting.
In the sauce.
So it's not so beefy.
No, it's not overly beefy. Right. It dilutes it a little. It gives it a slight vegetal thing. But you would never, I don't think if you were eating it, you would place it, you know?
Right.
But that's such a cool thing.
Right.
And I mentioned this to a lot of chefs, like when I started using that, and they'd say, what are the tricks that are in there? And I would point that out, and they'd go, that's really cool.
It is. It's very interesting.
But I've never seen
and actually,
that
I've never
else.
Heard of that before.
It's the only place I've seen it, and it's in this decades-old book.
Yeah.
You know? It's pretty cool.
It's a great book, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, but to your point, something like that. And it is not what people are generally writing today.
Right.
Although I do feel like, do you feel this way? I feel like chef books are getting more, there's always going to be the TV
books,
which are like products, really. But I feel like there's a lot of chefs now who are getting serious about trying to write more scholarly, serious,
I think so. There's a lot of chefs that cooks that read the books, and they that's how a lot of people learn about cooking is by reading these books from, you know, really well-known chefs that some of these recipes they use in their restaurants, and it's a really good, just like it was for me, it's a really good learning exercise for them, you know? So it adds to what you're already doing at work.
Yeah.
It's another layer. Yeah. So
tell me about your first restaurant job.
After going to culinary school?
After culinary school. I skipped over.
You don't want to know the other ones that weren't very impressive.
I do know you. Go ahead.
Okay.
We can skip. My I do know you had a gig at age, what was it, 13?
Yeah. I was working. Yeah, it was crazy. Okay. Anyway, but no, my first job out of culinary school was I went to work at Galileo in Washington, and Italian restaurant, and I was... I worked in the pastry kitchen. Yeah. Mm. So I wasn't a pastry, I wasn't a pastry extern, but they had, that was the only job they had. So they had, the chef at the time, he said, I've got to, it's like, I'm interested in an externship. And, he was kind of looking at me like, I don't know. Okay, maybe. And he said, I have two jobs. He's like, one's salad or garmanche and one's pastry. And then he's like, oh wait, salad, garmanche, we don't have that. So it has to be pastry. And I was like, okay. So,
but what was that noise you just made when you said he was like, cause you were American? What was it?
Cause I was an American woman,
woman.
And it was
he Italian?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All my chefs at that restaurant were Italian. So I worked with and the head chef owner, Roberto Donna, he's obviously Italian, but every single chef, head chef under him was Italian. So, American woman working in an Italian kitchen was like, one of the chefs asked me, he's like, why are you here? Like, what are you doing? I was like, well, I want to, my first iteration was that event. I thought I wanted to open a pizza place. That's how I started this whole thing.
Well, that's interesting.
Right. So I said, well, I think eventually I might want to open a pizza place, because I loved pizza. And he's like, he was just shaking his head, like looking at me like, this is not this is not, this whole thing is not a good idea, you know?
Yeah.
But he's like kind of shrugged and was like, okay, well, you know, this is the job we have. And I was like, okay, I'll take it. And so started out in the pastry kitchen and worked for a great pastry chef. Amazing. So she kind of taught me how to properly cook fruit in an Italian way, you know, which was really at that time sort of like revolutionary. People weren't really cooking fruit. And
when you say cooking fruit, you mean like in a, like a crostata or something?
Yeah,
like that?
Crostata, poached apples, poached pears, what kind of pear you use for poaching, what kind of pear you use for baking, you know, figs. I mean, I know this sounds strange right now in this era, but back then, like, people weren't cooking figs. Nobody even knew what a fig was, you know?
Yeah.
Or maybe in California, but not in Washington, you know?
Yeah.
So I learned a tremendous amount of about pastry from her. You know, some of these really classic Italian desserts like baba or, you know, a perfect tiramisu, because there's a whole lot of bad tiramisu out there, right? But like how you make a perfect mascarpone mousse, all those things I learned in the pastry kitchen. And then I, so the grill was very close to the pastry kitchen. So I was working in the pastry and had nothing but complete like respect and like fear and admiration for my pastry chef, Lori. But I was like also like lovingly staring at the grill where they were like grilling veal chops, you know, and watching these guys grill these veal chops. And, you know, so I kind of secretly was always like wanting to get over to the other side.
Yeah.
And, but you know, eventually they had an opening and they needed help. So
had you made it known that you wanted to be over there? Or
Yeah, but okay. I was, you know, the only job they had was pastry, so
no,
I...
No, but I mean, I know when you came in that that was the case, but I mean, as you, the way you were just describing it with this longing look in your face.
Yeah, I think
like,
I told...
while you were working pastry, did you say, like, hey, if there's ever a...
I think they knew I wanted to be there. Like, okay. I said that from the beginning, so they were just sort of like, when there was an opening, somebody quit or something like that, then... they gave me my shot. So I went right from the pastry to the grill. So there was no car mange. I had skipped car mange and went right into the fire. So it was kind of funny. Yeah.
And how did you do there?
Good. Yeah. But that was kind of like, it was kind of, you know, it was kind of intense. We do like 200 covers, 250, you know, you're grilling veal chops. But I learned so much. Like my first job was just like, complete and total immersion. I saw every single type of food that I had never seen before. So, you know, butchering squab, cooking foie gras, you know, butchering pigs, making porchetta, you know, you name it, we did it. So, I mean, everything and anything. So, like, it was like just a complete, like, mind-blowing sort of experience.
What was, you mentioned that the chefs, you called them, were all Italian. This woman, what did you say her name was? Lori?
Yes.
Was she American?
She's American, yeah.
So were there many Americans in the kitchen?
There was a couple. There was, like, on any given line, I worked there for, like, 6 years, so, on any given line, there was, like, two, maybe, you know?
And when you start, as you're going through that process, as you're there for 6 years, What becomes your sort of own personal barometer? Like, were you looking to be able to do, you know, you said before, like the right, you know, the classic, you seem like a real classicist.
Kind of.
Were you looking to be able to do that, or were you looking to be able to do your own thing within the, you know, Italian, it's, I feel like the arc of Italian food in this country is so interesting, because it was like, there were Italian American restaurants, you know, red sauce restaurants, which I personally love. I have no issue with them at all. I don't say that as in a disparaging way. Then, you know, it was like the northern and, you know, the authentic Italian restaurants were northern or southern.
Right.
Right. Like
mostly northern, right?
Mostly northern.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden, and this isn't that long ago historically, like all the regions, right? Like this is a Tuscan restaurant. This is a Sicilian restaurant. This is a... You go on and on and on, and people could get very specific, including Americans, right, who kind of dialed in on a particular place. But there was also, it started to become okay to take license with Italian food, which is so simple inherently that it does lend itself to that. If you want, you know, I think of someone like Jonathan Waxman here in New York, was kind of doing his own thing. His natural simplicity kind of dovetails with, I think, what is the core of Italian food. I think that works. Have you ever eaten at Barbudo?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I mean, I think it works.
Yeah.
But you can still very much be a classicist and that, you know. So I'm just wondering, what was your own sort of trajectory along this line?
Yeah, I didn't have a plan to do.
Does that question make sense?
Yeah,
that was
it does.
Convoluted.
No,
but...
no. It's I didn't have a plan to do anything in particular, meaning like it's kind of dangerous because I had no game plan.
Yeah.
What happened is I ended up in this restaurant and I just fell in love with everything about it. So, it was an enormous learning curve because I had to learn how to cook. I had to learn how to work in a kitchen. I had to learn how to do all those things I was just mentioning. And then also learn Italian because I didn't understand what anybody was saying. So it was really hard to be in that situation and be cooking. And then the chef comes in and is like, you know, che cazzo, you know, che dice, you know.
Yeah.
So like people are like, you know, there's some issue, but I don't really understand what's going on. So I had to learn Italian. And I was so immersed in learning all the... authentic ways to go about, you know, my chef was from Piedmont, so he was really like just trying to bring to bear his background, his region, his mom, you know, everything that was going on in his region of Italy, all the wines and all that stuff. It was just like complete authentic experience. And I felt like it was extremely important to because I was not Italian, I just felt it was extremely important to learn everything about whatever region I was working. We did Piemontese cuisine, but we cooked with so many different other cooks from different parts of Italy. And from time to time, we did regional menus. So we'd do like a Sicilian menu, a Roman menu, Tuscany.
Yeah.
We would do that for a whole season and you know... totally authentic recipes from all those places. But I felt it was really important to have a really solid respect and understanding for what authentic cooking is, because I couldn't do anything from that until I learned what that was. So, for example, like one of the greatest examples, I guess, is like bagna cauda sauce. You know, you see it all over menus now in Washington, or not Washington, but all over the place, right?
Yeah.
And I've had my fair share of bad ones, you know. so that is a, you know, Piemontese sauce that is a classic sauce. Like, I learned how to make it perfectly and can definitely speak to that and can definitely, like, I'm in a position where I can evaluate that sauce in other chefs.
Can I put you on the spot?
No.
No?
No. What okay. do you with
well,
what?
I was just going to ask you, what's the key to making a good bagna cauda?
Oh, I can tell you that. I thought you were going to ask me which chefs were which don't. I was like, "Oh my gosh.
What, whose were bad?"
Yeah, I don't know.
I
don't know any of them in particular.
This is proof that you and I have never met. I would never ever do that.
Oh, so what's how do you make it? Cooked very slowly, like very very thin slivers of garlic and anchovy in olive oil. Extremely low fire. Some people like to blanch the garlic in milk because it takes like that really strong taste out of it. I don't personally think it's necessary, but you have to submerge the garlic and anchovies in an olive oil and simmer it for, not simmer because simmer is like slightly boiling. So like kind of like just about to the point where it's boiling so that, you know, the anchovies melt, the garlic never turns color, but it's completely like, you know, cooked and white, probably a course of like at least an hour, you know. And then, you know, some people make it different ways. I blend it with, you have to have enough. So here is the trick, actually. You have to have enough garlic in ratio to anchovy and olive oil so that when you puree it, it doesn't break.
So because, that it emulsifies.
So it emulsifies. It's a very tricky little thing. Because even if it breaks, like, yeah, it's still bagna cauda sauce. But isn't it nice when it doesn't?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have to have the right density of the sauce. And when you're pureeing it, then you slowly, slowly, slowly drip in the cream. And then the cream will, like, magically, like, it almost turns into, like, whipped cream with the anchovies and olive oil, so it's kind of dense. And then from there, you can thin it out if you want. But that's the perfect bagna cava sauce to me. So what I don't like is like when it's like broken and like and greasy and stuff like that. So so my approach to cooking is basically like I like to respect the like the classic ways that these different regions approach their cooking. It's super important. And then, you know, from there I have been, you know, I've been doing this for a while now since that point. But so now I'm kind of liberated to cook a certain thing. You know, maybe it's a southern orientation or maybe it's a northern orientation, but I know whatever the components are, I know how to do the classic, I know how to do like an authentic representation of it. And I try to stay in a certain type of genre in that particular dish, but I don't mix regions, first of all. You know, that's the first thing. Like, so, you know, I would never like put a Sicilian sauce with like, you know, some kind of like, you know, Northern Italian like cheese thing or whatever. It just, that never happens. So everything like from a regional perspective is like authentic and makes sense. But I don't cook from a particular region. My restaurant is based on, it's a kind of a based on the market. So I buy everything for the week. I just buy, and then we stock the shelves, and then I go about making dishes. So you'll find different representations of different, you know, types of regional Italian cuisine inside each dish or plate. But it's not, I'm not creating like, oh, here's my, you know, here's the Tuscan steak with the rosemary potatoes and the da, da, da. That's not what I do. But my goal is always to be able to express myself and create super fresh ingredients. And then, you know, always with the mind that, you know, when an Italian comes in, and many do, like, are they going to recognize this food somehow? Are they going to say that tastes correct to me in whatever it is? And that's really important, because I think like if you go too far off the deep end, it's not recognizable to anything, and it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. That's my personal opinion. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like a penny bright, landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel, Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods. Heritage Foods was founded to sell ancient breeds of livestock and poultry that were becoming extinct, largely because industrial agriculture willfully pushed healthy heritage breeds aside for more profitable, faster-growing animals. Rare heritage breeds are saved when popular demand increases and farmers have the incentive to raise them. This Thanksgiving, we encourage you to buy a turkey from Frank Reese's Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch. Frank's turkeys are 100% purebred heritage, 100% pasture-raised, and 100% antibiotic-free. Turkeys are available in 2-pound increments. You choose your size. Don't wait. Pre-order your Heritage Thanksgiving turkey today at heritagefoods.com.
Welcome back to the show. We're going to get you back to the rest of my interview with Amy Brandwine of Centralino Restaurant in Washington, D.C. in just a moment. Before we do, I haven't done this in a while. I've just been sneaking it in quietly. But our ratings and reviews have stagnated. So I'm making my usual plea. If you've been a listener to the show, especially if you've been a longtime listener, I would really love if you could just throw a rating, and especially love it if you would throw a review up on iTunes. It really does help people find the show. I noticed that the show now, if I just go on to iTunes and search chefs, the show now pops up sometimes in the top, definitely in the top 10 shows. That's pretty great. That was not nearly the case even just a few months ago. So I'd love this to come up even higher for people, because a lot of the things that come up are generic food shows. And I think this is obviously maybe one of the most chef-specific shows out there in the podcast universe. So if you wouldn't mind doing that, I'd really appreciate it. You can also subscribe to the show for free on iTunes and Stitcher. And if you want to follow us on social media, we do drop new show alerts whenever a new episode drops. And the best place to do that is on Instagram. The handle is at Chef Podcast. That is at Chef Podcast. And with that, I'm going to get you back to my conversation with Amy Brandwine of Centralina Restaurant in Washington, D.C. I hope you enjoy the rest of it. Can you just give listeners a sense of the vibe of your restaurant, what it looks like, how many seats?
Yeah, it's it is modern, airy. There's 58 dining room seats, 16 bar seats. There's a patio outside, and it is really bright, very high ceilings. And then the tones of the restaurant are sort of like slate gray. Let's see, slate gray, white, and a little bit of terracotta here and there. But really high walls and, you know, yeah, it's got like a, it's very relaxed. Like it's like got these soothing tones to it, mm-hmm. but also clean and airy.
Mm-hmm.
So, the ambiance is pretty like kind of relaxing, but like kind of energizing at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I have a market that's attached to the restaurant with no walls, so you can literally see through the entire space. So people shop in the market, they mm-hmm. can look into the dining room, and people can be in the dining room and look into the market.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like got this really dynamic kind of vibe. And it was inspired by when I went to Rome, and I don't know if you've been to Ruscioli, but
no.
it's a you know, restaurant, not a fancy restaurant, kind of like an osteria that has this long market attached to it. And, you know, you had the long, long deli case with tables right up outside of it and then shelves of wine. So they had the retail thing and a dining thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really what started me. Like, I was like, this is fantastic. This is fun.
Yeah.
Why can't we have fun in Washington? You know, the restaurants are always like, you know, white tablecloth and super expensive.
Right. To those people that you,
yeah,
you ditched.
The formal servers and
yeah.
the jackets.
Yeah.
And I was just like, why can't we have like a fun time with Italian food?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what I set out to do with Centralina.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been open now?
3 years.
And what was the initial reception like for you?
From the beginning, it was incredible.
More than you expected?
Way more than I expected. I knew from my perspective as a chef and a consumer, I felt like there was a need to have a place where people could have a perfect bowl of pasta or like an amazing whatever and not have to feel uncomfortable. Like, can we all just have a little bit of fun? You know,
mm-hmm.
is that possible? You
mm-hmm.
know, can we have a perfect plate of pasta with a perfect glass of wine and somehow relax?
Yeah.
And that was really what it was all about for me. And then to like create kind of a synergy with fresh products, making those products available to bear in the market so people can walk in and buy the arugula that I'm putting on the plate. So it's not like some chef secret, you know, because a lot of times it's the chef that gets all the accolades and, you know, cooks at home, good home cooks could possibly make these things if they had access to the right stuff, you know, not
mm-hmm.
the grocery stores sometimes don't have good stuff. So, but yeah, the response has been incredible. And, you know, Washington wasn't always the most forward-thinking restaurant world. It's definitely come a long way, but I wasn't sure exactly how people were going to respond to it, except that I knew that it was the right thing to do. And then, you know, when people just, like, fell in love with the restaurant, I was so gratified because I was like, wow, like, what I felt like was going to be what I wanted to express in Italian cuisine that hadn't really been done in Washington before
right.
was an immediate hit. So
yeah.
It was very, very gratifying.
Mm. That's great. Now you mentioned a lot of
it worked out okay.
You mentioned when Italians come in.
Yeah.
What's that like for you? Do you get nervous cooking for Italians? Are you over that?
No, I don't at all.
Yeah.
I mean, not at all. No.
What do you hear from them? Do you talk to them?
Not really. I mean, the servers tell me, like, they said it's perfect, you know, things
mm-hmm.
like that. And that's good enough for me,
mm-hmm.
you know. You know, it's funny because Italians, a lot of times when they're traveling, like, they seek out Italian restaurants.
Mm-hmm. Do
so,
they?
Yes. So that's interesting.
That's so funny.
I know, isn't it?
Well, I just, you know, I've had this talk with a few people on this show that I feel like a lot of Italians, well, maybe it's, the one thing that we've talked about, sorry, listeners who have heard this conversation before, but I feel like people who cook Italian food and Italians are really particular about pasta. That's the one thing. Like, most chefs I know who cook Italian won't eat pasta in another chef's restaurant.
Right.
Almost everybody I know. Tony Mantuano was on recently, and he said almost never. Massimo Bottura was on. He said he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely not outside of Italy.
Right.
But maybe it's just pasta I'm thinking of.
Well, there's just a lot of...
Because I think Italians seeking out Italian food, it's like there's like such a chance of...
miss.
Yeah, and if you're in another country, not just the U.S., anywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's just a lot of bad pasta out there too, you know? But like I said, like I'm not fearful of any Italian person at all because I know I've been trained by many Italian chefs. Mm. So, I know what I'm doing. So there's never like a fear with that. They're just always very surprised. You know, they come in, they're very surprised usually because the food's so good. Like it's
you
so
mean like if you emerge from the kitchen or
no,
or they know you're in the kitchen and
no,
they're surprised.
I'm just they're surprised because they're kind of expecting maybe that the pasta's not going to be very good or something like that because they don't know, they don't seek the restaurant out for that reason. They seek it because they see Mercato Osteria and they're like, let's go there. You know,
let's go there.
And I did my most demanding experience was. I did some work for the Italian embassy before I opened the restaurant, and it was like working on their cafe and redesigning their cafe menu.
Yeah.
And so every day I would go to the embassy and cook at the Italian embassy for lunch, you know, for all the people that work there. And, you know, that was a particular group, you know, they were very, 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 very picky. But, you know, I was unscathed, but, you know, Italians can be very particular about certain things, especially garlic, you know, like no on the garlic. You know, a lot of Italians do not want, you know.
What do you mean? They don't want it browned or they don't want it in certain dishes?
Don't want it in certain dishes. Don't want to taste it. Not part of every Italian dish. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
It's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting.
I'm like one of these people as a rule of thumb, whatever a recipe says, I always add a clove.
Right.
Like I like
it too.
I don't
know?
Like it brown though.
Yeah,
I have friends who love it browned and I don't.
No, I don't like it brown.
I don't like that flavor.
No. Just when it starts to turn color.
Yeah. So what's the chef community like in DC these days?
It's getting bigger and bigger. It's changed a lot. You know, when I started, there was like a handful of really big name chefs, and then that was kind of it. And now it's just exploded to the point where there's just so many different restaurants, so many different chefs, and can't quite keep up with all of it. The chef community in DC is pretty tight knit, but it's changing to the point where. And I think much for the better. There's a lot more Asian restaurants these days.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of definitely diversifying the types of cooking, the types of chefs, mm-hmm. their backgrounds, you know, how they grew up. Like, I believe it seems like the culture is becoming much more open-minded, especially as younger cooks with very diverse backgrounds start coming up through the ranks and start to become named chefs in DC. Like, the culture is definitely changing.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was a little bit of an old boys network before and now it's much more diverse and I think accepting, and welcoming of different types of backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. You found a hus. I mean, you told that story a minute ago, but that, Well, first of all, it wasn't an American. But did you find it difficult? I hate asking people to speak for the demographic. But I mean, you just referenced Old Boys Network.
Yeah.
Was it difficult?
I couldn't figure out how to explain it. But
I don't have an issue with that. I just mean I don't want to say who. There was a pretty well-known chef on the show earlier this year, and before we started recording, she said, "Can we not talk about woman stuff?"
Yeah.
You know. So I don't like. doing, I don't like asking people to speak for their demographic.
Right.
You know
right,
what I'm
right,
saying?
Right.
But since you brought up that phrase, did you find beyond that chef you mentioned at your first job, who, you know, did you find that to be sort of an unspoken impediment or spoken when you were starting out? Did you feel a lot of chauvinism early on?
You know, it was sort of a combination. It was an interesting combination. There was a lot of women chefs when I started. I mean, not a lot. Let me back up. There wasn't a lot. There was...
Yeah.
Not a lot. But
not
there
in
were,
D.C.
Not yeah. a lot, but there were more prominent, well-known... there were more prominent, well-known women chefs when I started for some reason than I feel like there is now. Which is interesting. But I felt like in my own situation, I was in a very interesting situation because, you know, women were not really cooking in Italian restaurants at that time. It was very, not professionally, not at all, you know. So it was very unusual to see a woman working on the line. You know, it was like some people... some Italian men don't think it's correct for a woman to be cooking in those kind of circumstances, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So there was like a little bit of, it was a little bit of difficulty there. Interesting thing is that I felt a lot of welcoming too from the Italian people that I worked with at the restaurant because most of them learned cooking from their mothers. So there was like this double thing going on.
Yeah.
There was like this immense respect for women in the kitchen, meaning like, you know, that women are instinctively better cooks in Italy, right? In the home, right? So there was like this...
That's what they say.
The complete understanding that women were the experts at home in Italian cooking. And then just sort of like also like very backdated views on what women should be doing in terms of profession, in terms of like the right thing for them to be doing. So it was like a little bit of a whole hodgepodge of like conflicted... conflicted emotions on that. But, you know, I felt like the more aggression or more silliness from the American people that I was working with than the Italians, oddly enough.
Mm-hmm.
The Italians were much more, I think, they were very complimented by, I think they felt like it was complimentary that I was wanting to spend so much time to learn their cuisine, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
and put
totally.
Myself through what I was doing because I had such passion for what they were doing. And
totally.
So there was a sort of like a respect there, you know? So,
well, don't you also, I mean, I don't know. I feel like,
I don't know if I made, that made any sense.
It made total sense. But I also feel like to use a word that the late Tony Bourdain used a lot about kitchens, they're meritocracies.
Yeah.
Like if you can do the, if you come into a situation, I don't know how many people I know who went, back in the 80s, in this time in this book
I'll
I wrote.
I'll read your book, I'm excited.
But you know, I don't know how many people went to France to stage, got treated like garbage, Americans in a French kitchen at that time, where they thought all Americans could make is, you know, cheeseburgers, right? But if you proved yourself, then it was, that was it. They would turn around on that. You could easily turn people around just by doing the job.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, there were moments of hell. I'm not going to deny that. But most of a lot of the difficulties I felt was sort of the ribbing and I never really said this out loud, but sort of the ribbing and sometimes jealousy from other cooks, American cooks, because I was progressing in that kitchen because I was like just totally devoted to it. And I think that, I was just totally enthralled with everything about it. Like, I was just...
So you came in with this work ethic that you already had when you went to cooking school.
Yeah.
You were dead serious. You're going home and you're reading. You're like a sponge for knowledge.
Yeah, it's kind of it.
But that'll move you up the ranks in a kitchen.
Yeah, I moved up very fast.
Yeah.
Because I was, like, just 100%, like, whatever the chef said to do, I was, like, I was there 100% to do it exactly the way he did it because I was so appreciative to learn Italian cuisine from Italians because it wasn't an opportunity that really presented itself.
Right.
Like I would have to move to Italy to do that and I couldn't do that because I have the things we've already talked about. So I just felt like it was a tremendous opportunity. And so I felt very fortunate to be taught how to properly do things
Yeah,
but you know, from an Italian perspective, I felt very fortunate to be there because some people go and work for free, and here I was, like, I had a job where I was like learning from the best, and I was just like thrilled about it, you know.
Right, but you were also giving them a pair of hands that could do what. I say this all the time: it's the ultimate win-win. If you're in a kitchen and you're really serious and you have the goods, right? You can accumulate knowledge as fast as you want it, and I always say this: at the end of the day. This will sound like a lot. You'll tell me if you disagree. A chef, as much as anything, is looking in a cook for someone who will make their life easier.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I think that's a crass way to put it, but that's true. And if you're a cook who, you know, this person can do X, Y, and Z. Let's see if they can do PDQR. Like, let's see how much they can take on and if they can do it all well. Then the next thing you know, you're a sous chef.
Yeah, I mean, the goal is for the chef to have his or her cooks execute what they want exactly how they want perfectly.
Yeah.
So like that is really at the end of the day, all a chef really wants is to be able to teach and have the person who's helping you create your food is to execute the way that you want. And so when you find those people who are just machines and they just like, they are like, they're going to do it exactly the way you show them and they're going to do it perfectly. And the results of everybody doing everything perfectly is like, just that's all anybody wants. And so like to be a meritocracy, yes. I mean, at the end of the day, the chefs are like, you know what? I thought that guy was great, but you know, he's really lazy or he's really undisciplined or he can't, why the hell did you do it like this and blah, 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 blah. And then there's somebody quietly working in the corner. It could have been me or it could have been somebody else who's just like pounding away. And then they're doing everything exactly the way that you want. And they're producing the food that tastes awesome.
Yeah.
That you start to just like stand back and be like, wow, like, you know, like, this is just what it is, you know. We have to, you know, so person XYZ ends up getting the promotion because they are producing the goods, you know. And at the end of the day, all you have are either it's right or it's wrong. And so, I mean, you can't afford to have a bad cook or a bad sous chef.
Yeah.
That's like a disaster.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not there, these people have to cook for you.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So... it's a lot of responsibility.
So, not to put you on the spot, but 3 years in, what do you think about for, can I ask, are there future plans? Do you just want to keep honing this place you've got?
If there's
stuff you're not talking about, I'll edit out the question. I'm serious.
I'm kind of like, I've been kind of working on Chanchulina over and over again to like kind of perfect it. And then at the same time, like, I mean, if the right opportunity comes along that I don't want to open a restaurant or do something unless there's a specific need for it. I'm not the type to talk to real estate agents and be like, oh, like, show me some more spaces. Like, you know, I want to make tons of money. Like, that's not really, like, what I want to do. I want to, like, make sure that the first restaurant that I opened is still super hopping and busy and that people are happy. If there was an opportunity where I felt there was a need to do something, like Chanchulina, I wanted to do something. There was a need for it. I had a location.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I had something to express, something that had not been done before. That's why I was like so excited about that project. So if there was another situation like that, I would probably do it, but only if it was something that I felt like I need to express something, you know, or something novel or new or innovative, you know. I don't want to like create a restaurant that's just because.
Just to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know if that.
I love that. I mean, that's kind of an old school point of view, I think. I mean, everyone's so expansion crazy today.
I know. I
everyone wants a fast casual concept and everyone wants, you know, three restaurants in their home city and.
I mean, sometimes I see the dangers of too much expansion. You know, it's easy to lose control of things.
Yeah, quality control can go right out the window.
Quality control, but money and all those things. And, you know, I think I feel very fortunate to have one really successful restaurant. And if I did something, like I said, it would just be something that I felt 100% strong about.
Yeah.
And not just to make money, because it's not worth it. Because then eventually, like, if that's all you're doing this for, eventually it all goes away because you're not really paying attention to the restaurants.
Yeah.
That's my opinion.
Can you, for anyone out there who might be in a place where you were when you were thinking about switching, right, careers, is there any lesson you learned about how you went about it, if you would do it differently, or that you think you did just right?
I think I did most of it right. I would recommend to anybody who wants to think about going to school or whatever they want to do, they want to quit their job, to go work in a restaurant and work part-time. If the chef will have you, usually they will be okay with it. If everybody needs help, you know.
Right.
So learn what it's like to work in a restaurant. Learn what it's like to feel standing on your feet for, you know, 10, well, they're not probably not going to make you work doubles when you're starting out, but
right.
get a feeling for what it feels like to work on the line for, you know, 8-10 hours. And if you like that and you're still like excited, then you should think about doing the next step. Right now there's a situation because culinary school, however maybe necessary, is super expensive. When you get out of school these days, sometimes, you know, you've got big student loans and restaurants can't afford to pay tons of money that'll enable you to take those loans back. So, I mean, I think I would recommend somebody who start out young. If you kind of know what you want, start out young, go work for somebody for a few years. And then, you know, if you feel like you need to go to culinary school, go to culinary school and then come back into it. Or, you know, it's the commitment for school is not so intense. So it's not like you're going to lose a step of your career or something. But I would definitely recommend working in the industry first.
Okay, great. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
It was great meeting you.
Nice meeting you.
And I can't wait to come eat at your
restaurant. Please join me. Please join me.
All right. Enjoy the rest of your stay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Take care.
And that's our show for this week. I'd like to thank Chef Amy Brandwine for her patience in waiting for this episode to drop and also for that great conversation we had back at the end of the summer. Amy, when next time I come to D.C., you are the first chef I'm visiting. Yours is the first restaurant I will be eating at. I can't wait to try it, and it's long overdue, so I'm going to try to get there in the near future. To Vitor and Matt, the engineers at Heritage Radio Network, thank you very much for doing double duty and pulling this show together twice a week for me these days. I do appreciate it. I'm sorry I created this backlog, but what can I say? I'm zealous about speaking to all these people. Caitlin and Absentia, thank you for being my usual co-pilot. To Kat Johnson and Katie Mosman-Wadler of Heritage Radio Network, thank you for your help working out all of the extra work with the double postings each week. And thank you to all of you out there in podcast land for listening to the show. We'll see you back here very soon on Andrew Talks to Chefs.